From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Stephen Canfer returns to the show this week. We last spoke to him last year when his biography of Humphrey Bogart, Tough Without a Gun, was published. He promised to return to continue our conversation when the book came out in paperback. It has, and here he is. Stephen Canfer, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Delighted. Delighted to be with you.
You're such an interesting guy. There's so much to talk to you about in addition to Humphrey Bogart and all the things you've written about. We were just reading that you were installed as a literary lion at the New York Public Library. Does that mean that you're actually one of those concrete lions that sits out in front by the steps?
Actually, I wish I was, because this has been a terrific season. We didn't get any snow at all in New York. It's almost subtropical here. But what they do is they choose, I guess, 10 writers every year, and on various reasons of derangement, I was chosen about 10, 15 years ago. And we meet every now and then to discuss literature, but it really is quite an honor. I'm delighted to be in that august company.
Before you became a journalist, you actually wrote for some showbiz personalities. You were a writer?
I was. It's my buried past. I don't talk about it much. I used to write for Victor Borga, among others. And it was gags. I mean, there's nobody as funny as Victor Borga, and he was funnier than I could ever be. But he set a sort of tone, and I could write with a couple of guys. We'd write some of his better routines, I think. Not the classic ones, which he did himself.
Those punctuation.
But other ones.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the classic one that he does, the punctuation one. He does some others in that line, operas and so on. But we did some other things for his Broadway show, and that was kind of fun. And I wrote for Gwen Verdon also.
Did she have a nightclub act that you, or what?
Yeah, and she did. And I wrote some stuff with Dorothy Fields, who was just a wonderful lyricist, you know, Sunny Side of the Street and many another song, and that sort of thing, until I went legit and started to work for Time Magazine.
Right. That was your first job, Time Magazine?
No, I started in advertising. I worked for Young and Rubicam.
You were a madman?
Yeah, I was a madman. And as a matter of fact, I never watched that show because I was there.
Uh-huh.
And I saw it myself. But I went legit there, too, because Time Magazine was a client, actually, of Young and Rubicam. And I sort of knew one day I'd wind up there, and through various circuitous routes I did.
Yeah. And were you always the film critic at Time?
No, I started as a show business writer. John McPhee had left, wonderful writer who went to The New Yorker. And they tried a bunch of people I'd never seen to work, and they said, okay, we'll take a long shot on this guy, and they didn't. It seemed to work. And then after I was there about a year, the film critic, Brad Dara, quit, and so I took that post.
And, you kind of became a historical figure when you were writing for Time Magazine.
I don't know about that. I mean, I enjoyed writing movie reviews for about 5 years, after which I felt I got to get out of this. I just got to get out of this, because it was that unique sense of degradation you have when you see a movie at 10 o'clock in the morning and you come out and it's still daylight. You know, it's a very strange way to live. And also, it's a little like Plato's cave, and that is that reality then becomes something on the screen and everything else becomes sort of strange. And many another critic, I won't mention any names, has become like that. I didn't want that to happen to me. And as it happened, I really liked books better than I liked movies, and so I became a book critic and then the book review editor at Time. As I say, those days, Time was written in English, so it was kind of fun to be part of that group.
You kind of famously reversed yourself in one of your famous reviews, the review for Bonnie and Clyde. Isn't that right?
No, I did not. That was another writer.
Oh, uh-huh.
Named Alan Rich, who was a guest critic, and he knocked the movie.
Oh, I see.
And I saw it, and the managing editor said, what do you think? And I said, I really think it's an important movie. He said, go ahead and write a cover on it, which I did. But it was not me reversing itself. It was Time reversing itself.
I see. The magazine reversed itself.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that article that you wrote, the cover story, really kind of inaugurated the new Hollywood.
It did. At that point, there was a Hollywood to inaugurate. And, it's long gone, but, things like Easy Rider and other movies of that type really made a difference at that point. There were a lot of young people coming up, and Arthur Penn was really a stage guy who had gotten into movies, and Mike Nichols was a stage guy who got into movies, and it, you know, with The Graduate and so on. So it became a very exciting period, I must say. It was, and you look back at it and you think, how did they lose this? But they did.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, it's not a very exciting period in Hollywood.
Well, when you look back, you look at the English films, and you know, there was a time when Guinness was making those wonderful comedies, the Ealing comedies, and many of them, and you wonder, how did they lose it? It just happens. I think that there's about a 10-year stretch for any movement, including, you know, the Italian cinema, and there are giants there, and then somehow it's dispersed and goes elsewhere. And I don't know where it's going to land now. It certainly isn't here, however. And here's a French guy, a French-Lithuanian guy, who's showing people how to make movies and, you know, wins the Academy Award for his movie and his actor wins the best and all that. So maybe it's going to go back to France now.
What did you think of The Artist?
I liked it. I thought it was in many ways an in-your-face kind of movie in which a Frenchman says, look, I'm going to come to Hollywood and I'll shoot the entire thing in Hollywood and show you guys how to make a nostalgic film like Singing in the Rain, which you've forgotten how to do. So I thought it was a charming movie, and I do think it worked on that level. And I think he was very smart to use American actors, too, like John Goodman. You know, I think it lent a sort of authenticity to it. And it's a gimmicky movie, but it's a very good gimmick movie. And I couldn't call the ending. I don't want to give it away here for people who haven't seen it, but it's really quite a surprise to me. I didn't guess that's what would happen.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I agree. It was a fine film. Do you get to a lot of theater in New York?
I used to. There was a little magazine called The New Leader, and I had written some stuff for them, and they asked me, do you want to be the film critic or the theater critic? And I said, I've done film, thank you very much. So I was the theater critic for 12 years, and I saw everything, and at the end, I started to get too busy with books, and they said, well, you've got to find a substitute. And I said, how about my son? And he took over, and is now the theater critic for part of the time for The New Leader, which only exists very occasionally, but also for Show Business Weekly, which is an online and hard copy magazine. He's on there all the time, and something called the California Literary Review, which is actually published in Pennsylvania, of course. But he does those things as well. So when he's not being a private eye, so that's what he does, and it took over for me. But during that time, yes, I saw pretty much everything that was on Broadway or off-Broadway.
What do you think of the current state of the Broadway theater?
Well, I think the Broadway theater really is not the Broadway theater we knew. It's largely revivals and imports from England, that sort of thing. It's safe, but the reason it's safe is because it costs so much money to put on anything. It costs millions. Even off-Broadway, it costs $500,000. So naturally, they want a sure investment. Well, what's a sure investment? Mike Nichols and Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, are in Death of a Salesman. I don't blame them for wanting to do it, but I've seen several Death of a Salesman. I'm not sorry to miss this one.
You're not going to go. You're not going to bother.
No, I don't think so, no. I mean, enough is enough.
Do you think the time might be right for making a new film version of Death of a Salesman?
Yes, I do. I don't think that was entirely satisfactory. The worst Death of a Salesman I ever saw was on stage with Dustin Hoffman. That was John Malkovich played Biff. It was one of those springtime for Hitler moments when you sort of sit there with your mouth open. I wonder, how did they let this happen? But the movie is unsatisfactory. I think, is it Frederick March or something? I think
yes.
It's a lot of shouting. And, of course, one of the wonderful things about theater is that, you know, these blends of time are magical on the stage, and it's very easy to do them in film, so it's never going to have quite the same.
Do you know
effect.
Why Lee J. Cobb was not in the movie?
Well, I don't think he was a box office name. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just absolutely perfect as Willie Loman, that big man. The air is let out of him, and he's just barely able to get on when Dustin Hoffman played. He's a little guy, and it's not at all the same. But I assume that's what it is. There's often a case, there's no name for this, but there should be. The French would probably have a name for it. When a movie is made because an actor is bankable and they couldn't make it without him, and yet he's wrong for the part, like Burt Lancaster in The Leopard. Mm-hmm. It's quite a wonderful movie, but Lancaster is not right for it. It's just, but it wouldn't have been made without him.
The Man of La Mancha with Peter O'Toole. Or what about your pal Lucille Ball in MAME?
Well, she knew it was a mistake. Everybody knew it was a mistake when it happened. She just was restless and wanted to try something new, and it didn't work. And it was never going to work. I mean, she could carry a tune, actually. She was not a bad singer, but she was not a dancer. And it was sort of one of those ideas that 2 or 3 weeks into the show they knew was not going to work, but they had too much money committed, and she was emotionally committed, so they just went ahead and did it.
She was a little old for the part.
She was. I think she was really quite beautiful up until the last few years, and even then she was quite striking. You know, the hair was obviously no longer red, but she made it so. But she was just a remarkable woman, and I think only now people begin to realize it isn't just as a performer. Of course, she was historically very important because of what she did in television, but she just was a studio head, you know, the first female studio head in decades. And she made it work, and that's because Desi had set up a very strong studio, but Desi Lou worked because she was heading it at that point. He had gone.
Well, we're talking with Stefan Kanfer, whose latest book is called Tough Without a Gun, The Life of Humphrey Bogart. We'll talk about that in a second, but now I want to follow up on this Lucy thing you just said. I guess Lucy was really important in terms of race in America, and that because of her insistence, we had a multiracial marriage on TV.
Well, you know, you say racial and people say, well, he wasn't black. But really, the truth was that she was quite a white woman, very pale. And she and he, of course, tanned quite easily. He's Cuban. And they were on the West Coast once, and they checked into a motel, and I guess it was for dinner. And the waitress said, I don't think I can serve you. I think he's an Indian. And the idea was that, you know, a white woman could not be seen with an American Indian. And the racial component was very strong. Imagine trying to do this in prime time on CBS. But she insisted. She said, people said, they won't buy it. So what do you mean they won't buy it? I'm married to the guy. It's real. And eventually she persuaded them, and that show was immediately accepted by America. Became an enormous hit. I think she did do a lot. I mean, she wasn't Jackie Robinson, but she did quite a lot in the halls of power in the networks to convince them that it was really time to relax their whites-only standard.
Well, there's still a lot of complaints from Hispanic community that there's not enough Hispanics represented on television.
I think they're right, but that is loosening up. There are some very funny comedians, and eventually, you know, it's going to happen. I mean, there's just too large a Hispanic component in America for it to stay like that for very long. John Leguizamo is somebody I really love to watch on off-Broadway. Is Spanish. I mean, he's Hispanic. He's not Puerto Rican. I think he's Venezuelan. But he does 8 or 9 different people on stage. He does women, men, kids, old men, ladies. And he's just an extremely talented guy, and he's made it into a crossover entertainment. He began by doing it for Hispanics, and now everybody loves him, and he works all the time. He's hard to cast, but he's wonderful.
Yeah, he's great. Well, you know, you've written about Brando, Groucho, Lucy, Bogey, all personalities recognized by one name. How do you decide who you're going to write about?
You know, it's really an iconic thing, I think, more than anything else. I look around, and at the time I did Groucho, somebody had done him, and of course it was 20 years before, he was alive then. I knew Groucho because he used to come into town and want to see the film critic at time, and he and I would have lunch. By that point he was well past it, but he was still very funny, reflexively funny. And I thought, this guy's a real icon, he hasn't been done in a long time, I'm going to try this. And it worked very well. And then I began to think about other people. Well, Lucy was one of them. I had only written about Jewish men for a long time. I thought, I suppose I try a Shiksa and see how that works. And that seemed to work okay. And Brando was a very special kind of person in that he made a lot of terrible movies, but he made several wonderful movies, and he influenced a generation of actors, you know, ranging from De Niro to Paul Newman. They all worshipped this guy because he was doing something very different, and that is he was, in effect, living in the moment on stage or on screen. That's why he would sometimes refuse to remember his lines. It wasn't that he couldn't. It's that he felt, if you recite them exactly as written, it's Mary Had a Little Lamb, instead of really sort of giving yourself to the part and finding the words for it. So I think that was important. And then Bogart, this is just something that I have always felt. I think that he's one of these people that is bigger in death than he was in life. he just goes on and on. And I think that's because there's something missing in American life right now as far as the male image is concerned. So I really wanted to write about him in that way and see if that would work. And apparently it did. It got on the bestseller list, and I think that's largely for an older audience. I don't think kids exactly know who he is. They know it, but they don't know enough of him. But older people really do know Casablanca, and they know the African Queen, and they know Maltese Falcon, and you know, there are just iconic films with this iconic character in it, and he's was voted number one by the American Film Institute for a good reason.
And I think Casablanca still shows up on, you know, the 100 films. You know, I think they've done that list twice, and both
always. And I think it was today or maybe later in this week. They're showing it.
Oh, right.
With all the corrections,
like
in regular film theaters where you can see it big, and there is a difference when you see it big.
That's, you know, when I was a kid, and you were writing for Time Magazine, there were a lot of revival theaters. It was before there was video and home video.
Right.
And all that. And I saw there was a big resurgence of interest in Bogart, a Bogart boom, it said on the cover of Life magazine, I recall.
That's right. That was the Brattle Theater began that at Harvard.
Yeah,
and the kids would go to Casablanca, and of course, if you see it three or four times, you know all the lines, you know, whether it's Round Up the Usual Suspects or Here's Looking at You, Kid, or any of the other lines. I just know that. And after a while, I think he's probably the most imitated actor of all time vocally, because nobody can do him very well, but they think they can. You know, like the guy, and Woody Allen had a lot to do with this when he
did play
a film called
Sam.
Play It Again, Sam. Yeah. You know, and move a little closer, you know, that sort of thing that Bogart would say. And after a while, it became just part of the lingo of American life. Casablanca, of course, leading the way. So I do think that the theaters that showed it big had a great influence. And kids they've just memorized Casablanca. Now those kids have kids of their own.
Right. That's what I was going to say, is because, you know, after 1981 or so, when the video market, you know, kind of put those revival theaters out of business, except in New York City, where they still occasionally show old films. But around the country, you don't see theaters that show old movies. So, you know, I think most young people who go to the movies go to see, Transformers 3 or whatever.
Well, here's the other thing, is that almost everything is in color now, and color is really false. The Technicolor is not, the red you see in Technicolor is not the red that you see when you bleed. And black and white has a very different magic to it. Houston told me once that John Houston said that Bogart, if you met him on the street, was a nice-looking, not terribly tall man, but nothing very distinguished. He said you put him in a Warner Brothers black and white movie. First of all, Warners really know how to light their stars, but he had the kind of face that somehow was magical on the screen. And kids don't watch black and white movies. You have to pull a teeth to watch Sunset Boulevard, let's say, or High Noon, you know, really great, great exemplars of film art, and it's very hard to get them to watch it. And the ironic thing is it's never been easier. You know, three clicks on your computer and you have something streaming for you.
Right,
it's very hard to persuade them till they get to college and take a film course. And then their eyes are opened.
Well, I teach one, so maybe.
No, good for you. I'll bet you push black and white.
Oh,
do
I do, well, of course, because they're great.
Well, you know, Conrad Hall, who was a great cinematographer, said that he preferred to shoot in black and white. And I've found, and I wrote about this in Lucy, that color fights comedy. And all the great comedians, film comedians of the 20th century, with the exception of Danny Kaye, who nobody remembers anymore, started in black and white. Of course, Chaplin did, but people like Jackie Gleason did, and of course, Lucy did, and the Marx Brothers, and Bob Hope, and all of them started in that fashion. And it helped them because, you know, when Danny Kaye came along, everything stopped for the Goldwyn Girls to do six numbers, and you forgot what he was there for.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, actually, I was reading a review, I think it was in Time Magazine, of The Great Escape, and in the review it said, the movie is pointlessly made in a distracting Technicolor.
I think that's a very good point. That was not my review, but it's a very good point, and that is that color tends to move the eye away sometimes from the object. And because it's essentially a false color, it gives a fictive quality to something that you would like to believe is true. But everything looks too gaudy to me, anyway. I mean, there are certainly great Technicolor films, and Bogart made a wonderful one in The African Queen. It's a wonderful movie. But I think one of the things that helped that was that it wasn't a studio film.
It was made on location.
You know, it was shot on in Africa. In Uganda, those are a little more legit than on the back lot of MGM.
I also think, when I think of Bogie in color, I immediately think of The Caine Mutiny, which is a widescreen color picture. One of his better performances, I think.
Well, it's interesting. This is, to me, really interesting. As you know, I would go around the country showing just clips, five films. And one of them was the scene, you know, I had a key made. They called me Old Yellowstone, that scene. And I'd stand to the side, and I'd swear to you, sometimes I would look at it, and it was Richard Nixon. I mean, it's that same paranoid, clenched fist. And I realized it was Bogart before, you know, Nixon before Nixon. It was a wonderful performance.
Maybe
for that
Nixon
reason.
Based his performance on...
Well, the problem with the Caine Mutiny is that there's a romance in it. Talk about Technicolor.
Yeah.
And it takes up too much time. But when you get to the Bogart part, it's really quite wonderful.
Well, they could have gone with the Caine Mutiny court-martial, I guess, if they...
No, that was the one done on stage
with
Lloyd Nolan, and that was also very effective. You didn't have to do the whole Ensign Willie Keith number, but they did, and I think it was a mistake. But Bogart wanted to do that movie so badly, he took a pay cut, and he would have done anything just to play that part. He had been in the Navy, and I think he really felt that. And he also felt there's a Queeg at every studio, you know. He knew the man.
I bet he did. Well, we're talking with Stefan Kanfer and his new book, his most recent book. It's not quite brand new, but it's new in paperback, and it's called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Bogart, as he near the end of his life, and he was still a young man, but he never really acknowledged that he was dying?
Well, I don't think he acknowledged it publicly. I think he probably privately knew it. You know, he'd been a smoker and drinker, and that's a lethal combination because it affects the esophagus, and he had esophageal cancer. First, he had a very bad cough, and he ran into Greer Garson, and she said, "You've got to see my doctor." He never likes to see doctors. He went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, we think it's something, but we're not sure." And after the tests came back, and it was cancer, and particularly in those days, we're talking in the late 50s, they didn't have a lot of the equipment that they now have surgically and also radiologically and so on. So he was doomed, and his doctor, Dr. Brademas, said, "You know, when a man is in the throes of the last stages of cancer, you know what kind of wood he's made of." And Bogart was made of very, very strong wood indeed, meaning that I think he was very stoic. He really didn't want anybody's sympathy. He really didn't want anybody to come play a violin around him. He wanted to go out the way he came in, tough without a gun.
No, you never met Bogart, I assume.
No, that's before my time. Lauren Bacall, yes, but not Humphrey Bogart. No.
Well, when were you first entranced? Did you see his films when you were young, or what?
When I was a kid, everybody did everybody. I mean, when we came out of a movie, we were Cagney. You know, you'd do Dirty Rat and all the rest of us. We were never good at it, but we did it. And, you know, Bogart was one. We all did Bogart, not only the voice, but the kind of the attitude. He had a very musical voice, you know. "Oh, later you'll give me millions." You know, one of those up and down kind of voices. Yeah. And so he was the most imitated, as I said. So that was very intriguing to me. And also he was cool. And I didn't even know what that word was, but I knew that was the way you should act around women. You should be interested in them, but you should not give the cards away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought that's what a man did. And I also think when I got to know him through his own accounts and through people who did know him that I knew, that he was a gentleman. He really was. I mean, he walked on the outside when he was walking a lady down the street. He was very courteous. He was something of an intellectual, didn't want people to know it. Loved Bach, loved Debussy, read a lot, knew swaths of Shakespeare, you know, that sort of thing. But he cultivated writers rather than actors, which is something I guess I would do if I were in Hollywood. And so there was something very appealing about him that I felt even as a kid. I mean, I don't think he was nearly as tough as he was portrayed. I mean, Edward G. Robinson and Jimmy Cagney both said that he was about as tough as Shirley Temple. But that's not true on screen. He really does seem to be one of these people you simply cannot push around. And when he says, "I stick my neck out for no one," you sort of believe it in Casablanca, so that when he turns and, you know, signs up to fight in the war, it's a kind of great noble act. You identify with him. He's one of the few actors you truly identify with. You don't identify with Cary Grant. He's just too wonderful, you know. But Bogart's more flawed and therefore more identifiable.
He has such a beautiful smile. I love it on those rare occasions when he just...
Yes, well, it's not so rare. He gives a little bit. He does. It's not a long smile, yeah. But yes, he melts a little bit, and he has a soft voice. He never shouts, you know, unlike Cagney, who shouts all the time. He plays it very tight, close to the vest, and in a certain way, you feel he's as incorrodible as I wrote, as incorrodible as a zinc bar. You know, he's just not going to ever be corrupt. Maybe for a while he would be, but in the end, no.
Yeah, you know, I think his role in Casablanca was kind of the beginning of a period in his film career where he always played that kind of a person whose heroism had to be brought out.
Yes, and the renunciation as well. In Maltese Falcon, you know, a woman finally is exposed as the one who killed his partner, and he has to give her over to the police, even though he's in love with her. And certainly, you take the most beautiful woman in Hollywood at that point, Ingrid Bergman, and no, he's going to let her go to Paul Henri because it's more noble. What he will do is give her up because it's the thing to do. And like America itself, get involved in the combat.
Yeah. Well, Stefan Kanfer, it's a fabulous book, and everybody should go get it that hasn't read it already.
Thank you very much. You're very kind indeed.
And they can get it on their Kindle, too.
That's right. Yes, I get it on my Kindle. I think that probably is... unfortunately, the future of literature.
Well,
I like paper.
Speaking of the future of literature, what's next for you? Can you tell
us
yet?
Well, you know, I've sort of done an awful lot of bios, and I have just about finished a thriller. It's a genre I used to do when I was first writing novels, and I haven't written fiction in a long time. I thought, yeah, it's time to do that. And I'm an admirer of Lee Child and people like that, so I want to see if I can do it.
Well,
we can bring it off.
Look forward to reading that.
All right, thanks very much.
Thank you, Stefan Kanfer, for being with us on Funny Book Show. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org, subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, or check us out on Facebook. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I also want to thank my guest, Stefan Kanfer, author of Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.